back to the Iowa blog. I am your host, Craig Wynn. This is episode 2 of Mohammed's Criminal Enterprise, as presented through the 8th Surah, which is the spoils of war, and it begins, "Stealing is lawful and good." It is essential at this time, when you have progressives running rampant throughout European streets and on American college campuses, joining arms with Islamic terrorists and those pursuing the Islamic agenda, creating this myth that Muslims are victims as opposed to perpetrators. It is essential that you know the truth about Islam. Islam was created by Muhammad to steal. That was his primary impetus. He coveted what belonged to others, and he stole everything that wasn't nailed down. And his initial victims were actually his own family. Muhammad stole from his kin. And the story of Badr, which is the basis of the 8th Surah of the Quran, is Muhammad's terrorist raid against a civilian caravan for the express purpose of looting it. And so we're going to delve into that story. In the previous episode of Mohammed's Criminal Enterprise, I shared with you that we would be citing from the 4 oldest and most credible hadith sources and from the Quran. And I demonstrated to you that there's actually no difference between hadith and Quran. They tell exactly the same story. They're interwoven. One without the other has no value. In fact, the hadith collections of Tabati and Ishaq, for example, and Bukhari have much more value even than the Quran, because they convey Muhammad's words and his deeds. And it is Muhammad's words and deeds that Islam is based. The Quran constantly tells Muslims that they must follow Muhammad's example and his orders, but his example and his orders are not known from the Quran. They're known from the hadith, making the hadith essential to Islam. So as we return now to Muhammad's scheme, we read in Tabari, which is the earliest historian of Islam, in his collection of hadith from Muhammad and his companions. Volume 7, page 26, from the Sunni Press rendition of Tabari. "In this year, Muhammad ordered people to pay the zakat tax. It is said that the Prophet commanded them to do this." This means that Muhammad was searching for a way to raise money for his personal indulgences. He didn't fund anything that wasn't in his own selfish interests. And keeping up a harem evidently is expensive. Keeping up militants so that they can raid and plunder isn't cheap. And so Muhammad decided that he was going to impose a tax on the first Muslims. There would be two forms of tax. The tax of the zakat is a tax on Muslims. Then there's the jizya tax that is specifically stated as a form of utter humiliation, and it is imposed on all non-Muslims under Islamic control. And it is exceedingly onerous, and when you pay that tax, you have absolutely no rights. It is the very face of apartheid, and it exists throughout the Islamic world. It is said that the Prophet commanded this. So he was criminal enterprise. It is exactly what the mafia does. The mafia will go into a community, and it will tell all the businessmen, we're here to collect our tax. And they'd say, tax for what? Well, it's fire insurance. It is it's life insurance. Well, you mean you're going to pay me if my building burns down? You're going to pay me if I die? No, you're going to pay us so that we don't kill you and so that we don't burn your building down. That was the nature of the zakat tax. You decided you do not want to pay it, Muslims would kill you. They would burn your house down. Allah and Muhammad spoke with one voice. Paying the zakat became an order and then a compulsory pillar within the faith. The political manifesto was ushered in with these words, Ishaq 235. When the apostle, and by the way, Muhammad was no more apostle than he was, well, he was a sand pirate. He just simply stole titles from the religious practices that were around him. Christians had apostles, so he's called himself an apostle. In the case with Jews, there were messengers, so he called himself a messenger. The Jews also had prophets. Oh, that was really good. So he'd call himself a prophet. Clueless that to be a prophet, you actually have to issue prophecies. And if you're going to be a prophet speaking for God, your prophecies have to be 100% correct all of the time. And Muhammad never got a single prophecy correct, meaning he is a non-prophet. And a apostle is from the Greek, which means that one who is sent out. And Muhammad wasn't sent out by anyone. And the only time he left his brothel was to raid and plunder others. So we'll use the terms because that's what they say. And the next term, for example, when the apostle was settled in Medina, there was no Medina at the time. This tells you that all of these were post-dated. They were written long afterwards once Islam had conquered the entire region. It was Yathrib at the time. It was a Jewish farming community. So when the apostle settled in Medina and his comrades, well, that's an interesting term. He didn't have comrades. He had militants. Everyone that was associated with him was a jihadist. It was and remains a requirement in Islam. And his comrades were gathered to him. The affairs of the workers were arranged. There was no work in Islam. There wasn't a single Muslim, not Muhammad, none of the Muslims that define the nature of this religion, that become the basis of Sunnah, worked. Well, that is if you eliminate terror, raid, plundering, the slave trade. If you call those things work, then, well, they worked human trafficking. They worked kidnapping. They worked mass murder. They worked terrorism. They worked plundering others. They worked all of those kinds of things. They worked rape. But most people wouldn't consider rape, plunder, genocide as an occupation. I mean, if you put on your resume or a form because you're applying for a loan or maybe admission to college, occupation, rapist, pedophile, slave trader, mass murderer, terrorist. Well, I guess if you did that, most Ivy League schools and the most liberal would say, hey, that's our guy. Even better if he was a girl, but nonetheless, those things aren't work. There is no economy in that unless you're Genghis Khan. The affairs of the workers will arrange, and Islam became firmly established. Well, that's also untrue. Islam, which means submission, did not become firmly established until after Muhammad's death, when the war of compulsion was fought in Arabia, forcing all Arabs to submit or die to Islam. Prior to that, Islam was constantly on fumes. There were at least 10 times during Islam's first 20 years where it was likely that Islam was going to die and that it could not survive the stupidity of Muhammad. But nonetheless, it was absolutely not firmly established at this point. In fact, Muhammad was so desperate to establish his position as the godfather, as the head of this criminal enterprise, he was salivating to go rob a Quraysh caravan. That would be his own extended family. Now, the other thing that is interesting is the next line says, prayer was instituted, which is the prostration. That's the sign of surrender to Muhammad and Allah. That means that for the first 12, 14 years of Islam, there was no prayer. So This is another thing. If you're trying to think of how did the first Muslims express Islam, well, in the first 14 years from the time that Muhammad received his first revelation up to this point, there was no prostration prayer. And then it says the zakat tax was prescribed. Dictators, of course, thrive on money. Legal punishments were fixed. Well, there's the rub. You see, if you don't pay the zakat, then you are punished. So it is just like the mafia. You have a tax from the mafia, and if you don't pay it, well, they burn your house down and they kill you. Same thing here, except the death is not a single bullet to the back of the head. It's torturous in your demise. As were all things permitted and forbidden. Now, this is also telling in Islam. This is religion is just such a utter mess. The word in Islam for permitted and forbidden happens to be the same word. And so it is only context or somebody's opinion that determines whether haram means forbidden or haram means holy and wonderful, because it's the things that are bad in Islam that are forbidden are haram. And yet the central mosque in Kaabaville was called the Mosque Haram. So even here, Muslims have a tough time with their vocabulary. So as you listen to what follows next, please note that Yathrib was not named Medina until after Muhammad's death. I share this because when we listen and hear Mecca, for example, in this next hadith, the same thing is true. There was no Mecca during Muhammad's lifetime. Muhammad's Kaaba was in Petra. And it's obvious every essence of the hadith and the Quran's descriptions of what transpired scream Petra, and there is no historical evidence, archaeological evidence of any kind, that Mecca even existed at this point. So we're dealing with Petra, which is interesting because of the milieu of religions that were practiced there. Now, just as Yathrib was etched out of Islam's past and replaced by Medina, Petra suffered the same fate, with Mecca substituted in the 8th or 9th centuries. There were a number of admissions in this hadith from Muhammad's earliest and most credible biographer. To begin, the previous hadith have been clear. The only work of the Muslims, mercenaries, was as marauders. These comrades had merged together as a killer gang. The Muslims were completely ignorant and immoral malcontents from Kaabaville. It's kind of like today's Gaza. There was a report out by the United Nations that the economy of Gaza has suffered this tremendous blow. Well, Gaza didn't have an economy. It's parasitic. The occupation of Gazan Muslims was to hate and kill Jews. And, you know, that doesn't pay real well. So there was no economy. It was the recipient of billions of dollars of international aid, most of which was misappropriated. So the same thing is true with Islam's beginning. And Muslims from Kaabaville had arrived in Yathrib, which was a farming community, for one reason and one reason only. They came as a vicious gang of pagan Arabs into the Jewish farming community because of the fact that they were laughed out of Kaabaville in shame, down to as few as 5 Muslims by the time that Muhammad finished abusing himself, and the Pledge of Aqaba that facilitated his arrival into Yathrib was as follows. We pledge to wage war on all humankind. So with that delightful note, we find the Muslims now in the Jewish farming community. Some 30,000 Jews here, is the largest city actually at the time in Arabia. now living under the bloody swords of Islam. Every other habitable place had turned the disgraced vagabonds down and shooed them away. In fact, everyone, without exception, that knew Muhammad best mocked him. And it is the single most repeated theme throughout the Quran. There are well over 500 iterations of the never-ending argument, which is always consistent. Those who lived with Muhammad, who actually heard these surahs drip off his lips, said that he was a fool, a madman, that he was insane, that he was demon-possessed, that he did not speak for God, and that everything he was saying was plagiarized from other religious sources and then twisted to fit his personal agenda. So those who knew Muhammad best, better than any Muslim today, knew that he was a complete fraud. Now, by contrast, in the case of Yathrib, one small gang of thieves agreed to protect and obey this laughingstock of Arabia and his conspiratorial cult, even though they had amassed the combined credibility of their unbook and the tall tale of a flying donkey mule, which is why the Al-Aqsa Mosque exists. Well, that's not completely true, because Muhammad also came with the stench of having lost the never-ending argument, which was highlighted by the psychotic episode where he threatened to slaughter his family and friends. Then he accepted and then reneged upon the idolatrous indulgence, a bargain which made Islam polytheistic so that the nonprofit could wallow in immoral sex, pretend to be powerful, and count his ill-gotten gain. He actually cited in the Quran that Al-Uzza, Manat, and Alat were also goddesses along with his Allah, making Islam pagan. And so when the father of his six-year-old plaything, Abu Bakr, said, "Wait a minute, I didn't give you my daughter as a plaything for you to renounce Islam and make it as pagan as every other religion," Muhammad had the perfect answer. He said that all of Allah's messengers speak on behalf of Satan. And that became the stigma of the satanic verses, which is, by the way, written in the Quran, so Muslims cannot deny it. Therefore, this apostle came with a considerable amount of baggage and dirty laundry. Obviously failing to do their homework and likely ignorant of what we have just considered, a score of mentally incapacitated malcontents put morality and human decency aside and converted to Islam. As I shared, they pledged to wage war against all mankind. That is the Pledge of Aqaba. It is the first day of the first month of the first year of the Islamic era. So nothing in Islam mattered up to that point when these 20 pagans committed to wage war against all mankind. And it's something that Allah reminds them of, that they have pledged to fight to the death for him. So this egomaniacal messiah of madness called Yathrib, home, sweet home. But there was a little problem. They didn't have any money. So they had to borrow money from the Jews who had money. They had to live in homes provided by the Jews. And after a while, once they wore out their welcome, they simply stole their homes and exiled the Jews. And after exiling the Jews was not as much fun as they thought it might be, they started to slaughter them. So after committing to submit, obey, and then murder everyone and anyone, the comrades who were immediately arranged into armed gangs and sent off to terrorize civilians who were actually working for a living became the legacy of Islam. Muhammad's Mujahideen began by launching a dozen raids against the Quraysh. They were Muhammad's extended family, whom he had threatened to slaughter for mocking him. Ill-prepared and inept, they floundered, I should say, at first. But with practice, even as sand pirates, they hit their groove and successfully attacked, murdered, and pillaged those who had once been friends and neighbors, drawing First Blood as a gang of hooligans. However, in the process, these newly minted Muslim mercenaries lost sight of their polytheistic religious duties. And they massacred civilians during a month that pagans considered too sacred for pillaging. Insufficiently conditioned and controlled at the time, the Muslim vagabonds were on the cusp of being expelled for violating the morality of the people they were plundering. That was until the nonprofit and his ungod set them on the straight and narrow path to death and damnation with the second surah. It's called the crow, the cow. Allah has a thing for cows, justifying their new career as religious thieves. Having abrogated the failed religion in the surah and renouncing their vows, these Muslims were given a license to kill, a sanction to kidnap, authorization to enslave, a command to terrorize and plunder, whenever and whoever Allah wanted, which was all the time. This is how the apostle was settled in Medina and how the comrades were gathered to him and the affairs of the workers were arranged. It is how Islam became firmly established. The humiliating prostration prayer was instituted so that these Muslims knew that they were slaves to a wannabe deity and a narcissistic and psychotic nonprofit. And since thievery starts at home, the zakat tax was prescribed. Muhammad was given the authority to lighten the wallets of his raunchy raiders. But even that wasn't enough, because Islam's submission is the domain of the Zalem, the cruel lords and subjugating tyrants, and Muhammad and Allah were quintessential sadists. As a pair of despots determined to torment everyone, the legal punishments were fixed. Yes, you don't pay the zakat, you don't engage in the work of Islam, which is to plunder and kill, then you will be punished. The non-prophet and his ungod would determine and impose all things, both halal and haram. Then, when viewed within this context and what will soon transpire, as well as what had gone before, the hadith proved to be a succinct summation of Islam version 2.0, the post-abrogating follies and fables and Kaaba-ville, yes, in the second surah. Allah goes on record to saying that he abrogates. In other words, mid-surah, he can change his mind, cancel anything he said previously, and contradict himself. But that's all good because, well, he's a contradictory sort of a god. Yeah. Let's be real. Muhammad was a non-prophet and Allah was an ungod. And it's only ungods that have the prerogative to renege on things they have said previously. But that is the nature of abrogation. And it is in the second surah 2106, where all things that were said previously are subject to being annulled and replaced by something that is more fitting for Allah and Muhammad at the moment. Well, all of that Islam that existed back there in Kaaba-ville with the satanic verses and the idolatrous bargain and the donk mule ass ride to the city of Jerusalem, all of that would be for naught. We were now about the business of plundering. A benevolent dictator, Muhammad was not. Ishaq 280. When Allah's apostle came to Medina, Yathrib, it was the most fever-infested place on earth. No, it wasn't. In matter of fact, it wasn't even a place of static water. Water is very rare in this part of the world. And so it wasn't even within the top 10,000 most fever-infested places on Earth. It was actually a town, a thriving town of some 30,000 Jews and probably 10,000 Arabs. They grew dates there, and dates don't sit well in pools of static water. It smote Muslims to such a degree that they could only pray sitting. So you're going to tell me that that fever means that you can't stand up? Okay. Muhammad came out when they were praying and thus said, "Know that prostration of the sitter is only half as valuable as that of the stander." The Muslims painfully struggled to their feet despite their weakness, seeking a blessing. These Muslims were feeble because they did nothing. They were not engaged in any work. The Jews were out tilling their fields, and so they were strong, but the Muslims, not so much. And Muhammad mocked them by telling them that the prayer of a stander is twice as valuable as the prayer of the sitter. And yet, think of it. They're not standing. They're prostrating themselves, their noses in the dirt in total humiliation while they're mooning God. Well, once we get past the realization that Muhammad suffered from an empathy disorder as a result of being schizophrenic and, of course, being a psychopath, we are left with the realization that he was an unsympathetic and egomaniacal jerk. Further, this assessment wasn't even 1% complete. The diseases that cause mass outbreaks of fever are directly or indirectly waterborne, with either polluted water, failed sanitation into stagnant water, or mosquito-bred pools of water. Yathrib was in the middle of the desert. So it was sparingly nourished by wells and spring water, which does not cultivate any of these problems, especially since standing water would be rare in sandy soils. Yathrib was not near a river, a lake, or a swamp, so it would not have been in the top 1,000 most susceptible places for fever, much less the worst on Earth. Confirming the preceding assessment of Islam 2.0, the previous harsh denunciation of religious prostrations, reminiscent of a robust Sig Heil, was followed by a hadith showing that Der Fuhrer was doing what he was now best at, Ishaq 280. Then the apostle prepared for war in the pursuance of Allah's command to fight his enemies and to fight the infidels who Allah commanded him to fight. Oh boy, that's going to be a religious crusade, right? No. He wasn't an apostle. He was not prepared for war. War is when Army A fights Army B. They have a war, right? There were no armies. Muhammad didn't have an army. None of the people he attacked had armies. Muhammad never fought against an army a single time in his entire stint as the Godfather. Never once. So there were no wars. All there were terrorist raids. In pursuit of Allah's command, Allah's a rock. At best, Allah's the snake that slithered out of the Garden of Eden long ago. No, he was not following Allah's command. Muhammad was following his own desire for unlimited amounts of sex, power, and money to fight his enemies. Well, the only reason that the Quraysh were considered enemies is because they knew Muhammad really well, and knowing Muhammad really well, they laughed themselves silly at him because he was a fool. And to fight the infidels, the kafir, He didn't go off and fight any infidels. He went off and fought his own family, whom Allah commanded him to fight. Well, it is true that from this point on, Allah will have a couple of commands. One command is to fight and kill to the death. You continue to fight and kill for Allah until you die. The other is give Allah a goodly loan because Allah needs the cash. Islam in Yathrib was a declaration of war, obviously against all mankind. The failed religion became a death cult. It was as meritorious as the Black Plague. Allah's command to fight his enemies and to fight the infidels, whom Allah commanded him to fight. Simply stated, Islam is a declaration of war. The religion is a death cult. It has all of the merit of a plague. Muslims should be fully aware of this monumental shift between the failed faith and the caustic conflict. In the Islamic era, upon which the Muslim calendar is based, it begins after the declaration of war and upon the arrival in Yathrib, not upon the first Quranic revelations in Petra, 12 years earlier. That is why the second surah, noting the migration from one place to another, features not only the command to fight, but also the edict to abrogate everything that came before it, which would be three quarters of the Quran surahs. While the religious and progressives will chafe at this assessment, preferring their unfounded platitudes and unsustainable opinions, these are the facts. I heard Angela Merkel give this speech telling us that Islam was peaceful and that the few Islamic terrorists have corrupted their religion, and anybody who doesn't view that Muslims are loving and peaceful people, well, they're an Islamophobe. And that's how she justified destroying Europe. The fact of the matter is that Islam is exactly the opposite of that. That's not my opinion. It's not two different interpretations. The Quran is quite clear. We just read the Hadith statement. Allah ordered the Muslims to fight. Islam is founded on a declaration of war against all mankind. From this point on, every surah allegedly revealed in Kaabaville has been abrogated, and all surahs going forward are commands to fight and kill to the death. Angela Merkel lied. And that is what has plagued Europe. So while the religious and now their progressive allies prefer an unfounded platitudes and opinions, what I'm sharing with you are the unadulterated facts. They're irrefutable. Therefore, the difference between those who know and accept the truth, in this case, and those who cling to lies is a rational and informed mind and education through years of study. To embrace or promote Islam at this point is the height of ignorance and immorality. It makes person accessory to a crime. It is as compassionate as slavery, as merciful as murder, and as considerate as conspiracy. Fighting became such an essential part of Islam's formation that Tabari devoted the next 60 pages of his history to a single conflict. It's called the Battle of Badr. It gets five times more attention than Abraham's fabled pilgrimage to the Kaaba to allegedly establish Islam. It gets 10 times more ink than the first revelation in the cave, which was supposedly Muhammad's call to prophethood. It garners 20 times more coverage than the shameful migration to Yathrib, the Hijra, that instigated the Islamic era. How is it that a terrorist raid became the centerpiece of the Islamic religion? Well, the initial salvo of the battle to resurrect Islam nearly crucified it. We are told that Muhammad led his militants on a terrorist raid to rob another caravan in, of all months, Ramadan, when even the pagans eschew fighting. Tabari 7:26. In this year, the great battle of Badr took place between the messenger of Allah and the Quraysh, unbelievers, in the month of Ramadan. Well, since fasting was required in the sacred month, since the observance of Ramadan was a religious obligation and a pillar of Islam, why were the first Muslims and their prophet on the prowl at this time? Do you suppose stolen money was more important than pretense of piety? Well, at Badr, Muhammad was the aggressor, just as he was on 73 of his 75 raids. The non-prophet got to choose the time, the place, and the victim, and he elected to terrorize civilians who were returning home, in this case to Kaabaville, during the month of Ramadan. Reason would dictate that the non-prophet had discarded his calling and became a profiteering pirate, a money-grubbing scoundrel. By the way, Ramadan occurred at a consistent time of year prior to Muhammad, because everybody that was playing with a full deck knew that the only way that you could keep lunar months from meandering all around the calendar was to add an intercalendary month. So every 2 to 3 years, you have to add a month. There's actually a systematic way of doing that that calibrates the lunar calendar to the solar calendar to a tiny fraction of 1% accuracy. But Muhammad, because Allah was a moon god, couldn't have it that there would be an intercalendary month. So he said the intercalendary month was of Satan, did away with it, which is why the Muslim calendar just haphazardly revolves around the solar calendar at this point and is going back, well, before recorded history, because during all of recorded history, other men were smart enough not to do what Muhammad had done. Now, as you contemplate what motivated Muhammad to blend his scriptures and swords, religious fanaticism with militarism, to blaze a path for world domination that murderous Mongol marauders like Genghis Khan and Tamerlane would follow, consider this. Tabari 7:28. Abd al-Rahman said, Muhammad celebrated the night of 17 Ramadan. In the morning, traces of sleeplessness would be on his face. He would say, on this morning, Allah distinguished between truth and falsehood, revealing the Quran. On this morning, he made Islam mighty, humbling the leaders of unbelief at Badr. Now, when Muhammad received his first revelation, he acknowledged that it was Satan, and he acknowledged that he was beaten to a pulp and wanted to commit suicide because he had been demon-possessed. So if you want to attribute the 96th surah and this stupidity of asking an illiterate man to read, and then the stupidity of telling him that the great revelation is that man was created from a blood clot, and that the pen wrote a book that didn't exist and wouldn't exist for 100 years, and you want to attribute that to Allah, then it was Allah that nearly killed Muhammad, and it was Allah that demon possessed him. So that probably doesn't bear well for Islam's credibility. Anyway, submission was made mighty because Muhammad's kin were humbled. Allah distinguished between truth and falsehood by having Muslim militants murder merchants. World conquest through terror isn't cheap, however. Like today's jihadists operating as Hamas and Hezbollah, the first Muslims needed lots of money. Tabati, 729, and Ishaq, 289. The apostle heard that Abu Sufyan, he was a Quraysh merchant of some notoriety, was coming from Syria with a large Quraysh caravan containing their money and their merchandise. He was accompanied by only 30 men. None of these men were warriors. Not a single one of them was trained in anything other than trading. They were traders. And their business was, since nothing was manufactured in Petra, Mecca didn't even exist, all they did is they plied a trade. In this case, they could have, because of Petra's location, ships would dock at the Gulf of Aqaba, where the tip now is between Jordan and Saudi Arabia and Israel. And from there, because there was no Suez Canal, goods were caravaned from there through what was a watering hole in Petra up to the Mediterranean coast. And that's what they were doing. They were just carrying goods back and forth, and they were just businessmen, merchants. These merchants and traders were going about their lives, of course. They were working to make a living, something Muslims were unwilling to do and are largely unwilling to do today. Therefore, Islam was about to rob them. Their only crime was to underestimate the caustic nature of Islam, which left themselves vulnerable to it, just as is the case today. Tabati, Volume 7, page 29, and Ishaq, the Sirat Rasul Allah, as translated by Ghulim and published by Oxford University Press, page 289. This was after fighting had broken out between them and people had been killed and taken captive at Nakhla. Now, if you're reading this out of context or you stumbled upon it, one might assume that the opposing parties were at war and that both were to blame for escalating the hostilities. But those who have read Goddamn Religion up to this point and are familiar with the Islamic Hadith know better, because the Islamic scriptures have shown that the Quraysh were merchants and that the Muslims were militants. They had set out on a dozen terrorist raids. They had ventured out as far as 200 miles to rob civilians, their own family, their former friends. They were the sole perpetrators. The Muslims killed Hadrami in cold blood. They kidnapped his companions and they held him for ransom during what we call First Blood in Islam, which preceded this by a few months. Ever inclined to put their best possible spin on their violent beginnings, the first Muslims claimed, Tabati 729, this incident had provoked a state of war between the Prophet and the Quraysh and was the beginning of the fighting in which they inflicted casualties upon one another. In other words, before the Islamic raids, there was no fighting. Not a single Muslim had been killed. In fact, there were no armies. The Muslim raiders were mujahideen. They were jihadists. They were terrorists, with a coarse religious twist for blood and booty. The Quraysh were simply merchant traders, businessmen in today's vernacular, working for the benefit of their families. But if pirates are shady entrepreneurs, Muhammad was a profiteer par excellence. He was consumed by the passion to plunder. He had found his calling at long last. Ishaq 288. Allah divided the booty stolen from the first caravan after he made spoils permissible. He gave 4/5 to those he had allowed to take part and 1/5 to his apostle. Yep. That was Muhammad's entire deal. When he convinced these 20 pagans from Yathrib to declare that they would protect him as they would protect their women, and that they would wage war on all mankind and go off and plunder for him. The sales pitch that Muhammad offered them was if they were to plunder for him with his God's permission, that they got to keep 80% of what they stolen, and that he would take his 20% for himself personally, of course. And there's no hiding the fact that he took it for himself personally. And that so these new raiders would do all the work, and Muhammad would receive 20% as a cut, like a good godfather, I guess. And he then went on to say, and if you were to get killed fighting and killing for me, robbing for me, then that's going to be okay too, because Allah will reward these killers who are out stealing from others with multiple virgins in paradise. Now, how stupid do you have to be to believe that is beyond my comprehension. But nonetheless, there are 2 billion Muslims that believe that stupidity even to this day. Well, unless stealing is considered moral, a good deed in Islam, why would Allah divide the stolen booty as opposed to returning it? How can Islam be good when its God is so bad? How is anyone supposed to believe that Allah was Yahweh when Yahweh etched the following in stone? And I'm going to share this with you. It's from Shemot Names, Exodus 20. Because every once in a while, we have to infuse some actual truth and reality into this milieu of maniacal rubbish. Almighty God commanded all of these statements in our presence, providing perspective by explaining. I am reading from Exodus 20. Tablet 1. I am Yahweh, your God, who relationally and beneficially to show the proper path to get the most out of this life and to engage in a beneficial relationship, brought you out and delivered you, descending to serve you by doing everything which is required to withdraw those of you who respond away from the realm of the crucibles of political, religious, economic, and military oppression, out of the house of slavery, away from worship and servitude, government authority, and religious officials. You would not have continued to exist with other gods over and above my presence. You should not continue to associate yourself with or make a practice of attending to a religious image, object of worship, or any representation of a god which is in the heavens above, including the sun, moon, planets, and stars, or that which is on the earth below, or which is in the waters beneath the land. You should not speak about them on your own initiative or make a practice of bowing down and worshiping them. You should not continue to promote their message, nor display their words, because such uncoerced and ongoing verbal declarations will influence you. And you should not worship them, nor should you serve them or encourage anyone to be passionate about them. Do not labor in their cause or make a career of serving as their ministers, or inspire anyone else to do so. For indeed, emphasizing this point, I, Yahweh, your God, am a fiercely protective, steadfastly loyal, and jealous God, a God who is desirous of exclusivity in a devoted relationship. I consider and reckon the perversity of twisting and distorting, and the depravity of perverting and manipulating, deviating from the way of the fathers upon their sons to the third and fourth generations of those who are openly adverse to me, who are malicious while shunning this relationship. And yet, I will genuinely act and actually engage to prepare and produce unfailing mercy, unearned favor and genuine kindness, even forgiveness, developing a friendly and loving relationship on behalf of thousands who move toward me out of love, forming a close, familiar relationship, caring enough to know me and also who approach me by closely examining and carefully considering my instructions, the terms and conditions which uphold my covenant. You should not deceive, nor should you tolerate or support the delusions of others. You should not advance schemes which enrich yourself by indebting others, and you should avoid beguiling people such that they become forgetful, causing them to miss the way. Do not negate the name and reputation of Yahweh your God by advancing worthless deceptions. For indeed, Yahweh will not forgive or pardon from guilt, neither exempt from judgment or sentencing an individual who consistently deceives, who actually beguiles and deludes, using religious duplicity to mislead, lifting up or advancing dishonest ruses to forget this association with his name and proper designation through vain and ineffectual lies which lead to lifelessness. Tablet 2. Remember to genuinely reflect upon recognizing that the Shabbat, which is the seventh day, is set apart to approach him. 6 days you should work, laboring for oneself or others, expending the energy to be productive at your job, and choose to act, engaging in all of your service, communicating as a heavenly messenger in conjunction with the spiritual counselor. The seventh day, representing the promise which fulfills and satisfies, abundantly benefiting the observant on this enriching day, the Shabbat, this period of reflection on the relationship at the end of the week, it is to approach Yahweh your God. You should not continuously engage in all of the work of the heavenly representative and spiritual messenger, yourself, your son, your daughter, your male and female servants and staff, your means of production, as well as those visitors who are in your home or your property. And for in 6 days, Yahweh acted and engaged and produced everything associated with completing, celebrating, and attending to the full extent of the heavens, including the spiritual realm and the earth, along with the entire material world, even the waters and all which is relationally in them. Then he became completely settled spiritually during the Almighty seventh day. Therefore, Yahweh blessed and adored, offering a greeting along with an opportunity to meet, favoring everything associated with this day, the Shabbat, setting it apart, separating it from that which is common, ordinary, and popular, making it special. You should choose to carefully consider as worthy, valuable, and significant, and highly enriching, perceiving as awesomely impressive, and tremendously relevant, even important, as well as abundantly enriching and empowering to a significant degree by the symbolism of your father and that which is represented by your mother, for the purpose of continuing to lengthen your days upon the earth, which, as a benefit of the relationship, while revealing the narrow, correct, and straightforward steps to walk along the path to get the most out of life, Yahweh your God is actually giving to you. You should not kill. On an ongoing basis, making a practice of taking the life of another, whether by accident, revenge, manslaughter, predetermination, assassination, government execution, military slaughter, or murder. You should not continue in an idolatrous worship or make a habit of taking another's wife. You should not make a habit of stealing, routinely stealing, taking something from others without their permission. I'm laughing here because every one of these is violated throughout by Allah and Muhammad and Islam. They make a complete mockery of all of this. You should not continually answer and respond against your neighbors with evil thoughts or debilitating ways of your countrymen as a deceptive, misleading, or unreliable witness. You should not make a practice of desiring, habitually coveting, delighting in, or lusting for your troublesome neighbor's home or household. You should not continuously covet your associate's wife or his male or female servants, his comings and goings are his domesticated animals, his means to transport food and production, or anything which is associated with your malignant countrymen's errant opinions and inappropriate behavior. Wow. That's the 10 statements that Yahweh etched in stone. It is as if Yahweh was shown a copy of the repulsive Quran, as well as his people's Talmud, in addition to the New Testament, before offering this assessment. From first word to last, it repudiates religion, and it devastates Islam. To claim that the God who etched these words in stone, some 3,475 years ago, is the same as the illiterate and inarticulate liar promoting thievery in his unbook is to have lost all touch with reality. Well, we're going to pick up the story of Muhammad's criminal enterprise and part three of this series in our next episode. So I thank you for listening. I thank you for allowing me to end on a sane note and actually cite something from the Torah that is so pertinent to how we should live our lives and so hostile to the religions which have usurped Yahweh's credibility to mislead billions of souls. This has been an episode of the Yahweh Blog, and I am your host, Craig Wynn.